In typical Futile Podcast fashion, starting off with a little
preamble.
Preamble.
Or of an ambling.
It's all a preamble.
It is indeed. No. So yeah, we were just talking, you just saw Jurassic Kingdom Fallen World.
I saw Fallen 2. Kingdom of the Sun.
Right. With Denzel, is he back
Denzel
for Fallen 2?
And John Goodman, and yeah.
Nice. That's actually a pretty good movie. It's pretty creepy, yeah. Pretty good movie.
I remember who was involved with that. I don't recall. It was so long ago.
That's somebody weird who's like a jobber director who did like two or three okay things.
I want to say John Dahl, like, everything that was supernatural thrillerish for a while, I always conflate with Stir of Echoes, which was done by...
Kep?
Was it Kep?
That was all Kep.
Yeah, so one of the hacks, mm-hmm. one of the hack guys, like, directed that, and so I always think, like, someone else like that also wrote all those...
Who was it, T.S.?
T.S. Eliot?
No, Tony Scott.
Oh, no.
Doubtful.
Tony Scott's dead, you know.
I know. It's too bad, actually.
He probably had a handful of pretty good movies. I don't think he ever really made a bad movie. He never maybe really made a great movie, but I think his...
Yeah, you know,
that's one of those like fan things. And now that he's dead, people, of course, are coming out of the woodwork to appreciate.
I've had this
Crimson Tide and
conversation,
True
with,
Romance, and stuff.
Had this conversation with people about how Ridley Scott is capable of just absolutely transcendent excellence, or was in the past. Plus, he also would do stuff with more prestige involved, so, you know, he's had Oscar-winning films, etc., etc. But Tony Scott had far fewer lows than Ridley, because Ridley has made some really strange, just baffling decisions, like, I'm going to direct this piece of shit, or something like that, you know, and you're like, what? Why? You know, he's one of those guys who just seems like something might come up on a whim, and he's like, yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah,
you know, where you expect or you want him to do a certain thing because he's, you know, he's directed some of the most iconic genre films of all time, but they weren't genre films. They were just excellent films.
Sure.
Dramatic elements, all that stuff there, and just, you know, and then he's slummed with just trash and garbage that has been really questionable.
Or done even...
But Tony Scott never had lows like that. His stuff was always baseline... at least mediocre popcorn movies, you know? Like, that tended to be his thing. He had a particular look. He was one of the Bruckheimer guys.
Right.
So, you know, he had a particular style and looked that fell in line with all that stuff. And he had some pretty good movies, but he never had anything that came close to Blade Runner or Alien, for instance.
Right.
You know?
I mean, Ridley Scott's a tricky one, I think, because he's been... I think he recently went through a fairly prolific phase of just putting out a lot of stuff that... Maybe some of it was just like I saw that Body of Lies espionage movie. Mm-hmm. I think that was him. There's like literally ones where like I think that was him. I didn't see The Counselor, but I heard that was good. But it looked like it was in the same vein as like a lot of these other movies. Like, he does like
you know. I was just thinking of that again. I would really like to watch The Counselor again. That is, it's a really weird one. You know, when I watched it, I was put off because I was like, this is breaking all the rules in a bad way. It's 99% dialogue.
Yeah.
It's just a talking movie. Well, and it's because of Cormac McCarthy.
Which is fine if it looks good, but you know what I mean? Like No Country for Old Men is a lot of talking.
It does everything you think it will. Everything that they set up all these things. Like, I'm gonna set you up this job. This is gonna happen. This is gonna happen. This is gonna happen.
Yeah.
And a warning, something, something, then it'll go wrong. And every single thing happens is exactly how they explain it. And it's not, you know, it's not surprising.
It's by the numbers, but it's
well executed. It's not necessarily by the numbers. It's just very strange. And what's interesting to me is that I came out of it, it's the type of thing that I would like. And I came out of it being kind of like bemused a little bit. But everyone I've spoken to since then... And a lot of the critics that I've read since then, since, you know, originally it came out and it got, like, so-so reviews and people have been like, you know, I really like it. And it stands out.
Right.
It stands out for what it is. It's worth seeing. Gregory Hoblit directed Fallen from a screenplay by Nicholas Kazan. Must be Ilya Kazan's relative.
Something like that.
So, nobody's.
There you go. Yeah,
Donald Sutherland was in that. I forgot that.
Oh, he was in a lot of those.
Elias Koteas, of course.
Of course.
Nicholas Kazan, 72 children. Zoe Kazan.
Right, makes sense.
Parents, Elia, yeah.
Well, there you go. So that was Fallen, but that's not what we were really talking about. You're talking about the Jurassic Park 5? JP5 is how they marketed it, right?
It's JW2:JP5.
Sounds
like,
good.
Like Alien versus Predator.
Right, exactly.
I once wrote a very long, complicated story for an online magazine my friend made, or like literary site that my friend made. And it was all about, I tried to make it as verbose and as long as possible, describing
the nomenclature.
And the numerology of the Alien movies with the Predator movies, and then the combined Alien-Predator, yes, whatever. And then I predicted what the future ones would be called, because...
The Chimera.
Because the way they went, it was Alien versus Predator, and then the sequel was Aliens versus Predator.
Mm-hmm.
With a subtitle,
Requiem.
You know, right? But first one was Alien versus Predator, and then it was Aliens versus Predator,
and then it was Predators.
Then it was Predators, and now it's just the Predator.
Yeah, again,
even though there's Predators in it, so it's all very confusing. And actually, in another thing I watched, I just got out of was Sicario 2, Day of the Soldado, and most of the movie I was sitting there thinking, what happened to calling things two?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't get it. Because there's going to be a third one.
Right.
And it's going to be Sicario something, something, something.
But you know there's going to be a third. Like, there's a deal already set up. There's going to be. They already paid the actors, even though this movie's apparently not getting good reviews and pretty tasty.
It's getting, you know, it's getting middling reviews, and probably rightfully so, but it's better than most things I've seen.
So that's one of those cases of everyone.
Did you see
inflates the first one, and then
did you see Proto Sicario?
Yeah, I saw the first one. Okay. Yeah, I own the first one.
Oh,
I
mean,
it's Denis Villeneuve. It's got a good style. I think. Are a lot of people just butthurt that what's her name's not back?
Well, it was an interesting. It's very a weird choice because she was the moral center. She's the
right
person who
that was the entry point.
She's the entry point, and she shows the shock and disgust
right
the audience is supposed to have with this world.
Yeah.
You take that out in this one.
But in a weird way, she was kind of... Her story was maybe kind of done by the end of the first movie.
It was. It makes sense when you
right
watch this one. It makes sense. And, you know, you end up giving those two monstrous characters in the CIA guy and the hitman, you end up giving them their own moral agency, rather.
Right.
So I thought it kind of worked out in that way, because she was the only person with moral agency before.
Yeah.
And now they both have things that they have to, like, turn their backs on because of their ethics or whatever.
Sure.
You know? And you wouldn't think they had
so
it.
So you think this is one of those things that, like, when the dust settles a year or two from now, people are going to kind of shrug about, like, it wasn't that bad.
Well, I don't know if anyone's saying it's bad. I think the reviews have been like...
Most of the Letterboxd stuff is in like the 1 to 2 star range, which is
really?
Like... Yeah, for people.
All the reviews, I have seen have been like, you know, B-,
yeah,
C+, stuff like that, which is...
That's, I guess, 1 to 2 star maybe for most... I don't really know.
I don't think so. I mean, that's it.
Anything like a D is like a half star, you know? I mean...
I mean, here's the thing. I might as well just give the ratings right out front. Sicario 1... 3.5 out of 5. Sicario 2 was a low 3.5 out of 5.
You mean your 3.5s, yes.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah,
it's about the same.
It's like Marvel
when
movies.
It comes down to it.
Are they going to connect the Sicario universe to the Marvel universe at this point?
They should.
Yeah.
And what they really need to do is throw a transporter in there, so it's
of course
all part of the Michael Mann movies and everything like that.
I like that, yes. This is what we discussed.
Michael Mann universe.
The Manverse.
So Sicario 2.
So you just walked out of that?
You just walked
out. I mean, I didn't walk out, but finished it.
I finished the film and I left.
Never walked out of a movie before, have you? Unless you, like, had some emergency, probably. I could see where, like, you.
Yeah, no, I don't think I ever have. I've never. I know a lot of people who've left movies just because they're like, I didn't want to watch it anymore, or whatever. And I just couldn't. I can't do that.
Yeah, I
can't imagine a world where that's okay.
I even had that happen with a streamer I was watching yesterday. I literally was like, this is getting so stupid and tedious and inane, and I just stopped it for a minute and then, like, started to look for something else, but I was like, I gotta just, like, I can't, you know, like, I gotta feel like I at least saw it through. Otherwise, it lingers.
It's impossible to give anything its fair shake unless you stick through to the end.
It kind of is, but there's so much crap these days that, like, I'm starting to feel like I want to develop some kind of system where I can, like, either just short, you know, cut myself off ahead of time preemptively. You can, the annoying part is you can almost, like, a lot of these ones, like, will have, like, the IMDb rating or something else up there, you know, like some kind of out of 5-star rating that the general populace right. or some is giving it. And more often than not, those are pretty accurate.
Those are irrelevant.
Right. But I mean, like, in terms of, like, do I feel like watching a movie that's a 6.5 out of 10? Or do yes, I feel like watching a movie always. That's like that's better than that, you know?
I prefer the lower things because there's probably something wrong with them, and that's good.
Well, I mean, there's character and the flaw, there's being able to see the seams of the filmmaking, but then there's just, this is just middling and lame and mediocre and whatever.
Now, Sicario's was not middling. That's the thing, is it probably is not as good as the first one. It's a different thing and it's questionable, but it's suspenseful. It held my attention
right.
more so than a lot of things. I really, the cinematography is great. Score was great. It's got, I mean, it's becoming a standard thing, but it's the noise score that goes,
right.
that sort of thing these days, which I like, you know, and the acting's good, and it's like, it's intense, and it's about something frightening that's right around the corner and, you know, right down south, and it's the usual thing. But there's nothing wrong with it. It's every, you know, there's no such thing as any a movie that comes out and surprises you.
I guess. I feel like certain things can. Usually it's just not a good thing. But we can get into that later. This is our big 400 episode. 400.
This one is?
This one is a 400. We'll reminisce and we'll have fun. You just gave your Sicario's review.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can talk about JW2, JP5.
And I can't believe you don't want to see Jurassic World 2.
I didn't even see the first one in the theater.
You didn't see the first one?
No. I've seen the first two Jurassic Parks in the theater. And if I can confess this, and I've probably said it on the podcast before, the first Jurassic Park, I own it on Blu-ray, I got a kick out of it on some level, but even the very first time I saw it, both the ending and other parts of it just didn't cling for me. And I was thinking about it today, and I think part of it is that you're given, like, in Spielberg's movies, a lot of times there's, like, a kid, and, like, you follow the kid. Mm-hmm. But in Jurassic Park, it doesn't start with the kid, it starts with the doctor, with Grant. And he's kind of hard to like, connect with, especially as a kid. You're like, you know, he's kind of a doctor. Is he like an Indiana Jones? Is he kind of an adventurer? Is he sort of a scientist? And Sam Neill just kind of plays it very, I don't know. And then when they do introduce the kids, they're obnoxious. And then you don't really care about seeing what happens to them. Sure, the effects are cool. And, like, the scope is neat. And then some of the, you know, but and then it becomes more of a horror movie in places, which, whatever, I'm okay with. But I was never a big horror guy. And then the ending is just like, okay, then they just escape on the helicopter, you know? And so I feel like so many other people, like, love Jurassic Park, like it's in their top 10 or whatever. Yeah,
it's one of my top 5 movies of all time.
And I'm just like, shrug. Like, it'll never get above a 3.5 for me as many times as I could watch it. I don't think there's any way anyone
To be fair, it's probably a 3.5.
Right. Well, there you go. But you've got your personal connections to it or whatever. And I just don't...
I saw that over 10 times in the theater.
That's insane.
Well, because they kept playing it at the dollar.
Well, fine.
So I saw several of those for a dollar.
Sure. But I just don't know what you would keep getting out of it after about 3 viewings or something.
It's suspenseful. It's a suspenseful
in a thriller. Couple of spots.
Oh, and the whole movie.
Giant dinosaurs chasing people. I mean, you know.
Yeah, it's great. That's exactly right.
The little dinosaur stuff is good.
Describe why it's so great. Now,
the new ones. I watched the new one with Seth and Olivia... on just DVD or whatever, and I was trying to give it a fair shake. I was like, oh, it looks like an okay concept and everything, and I'd heard kind of, like, yeah, it's not very great or whatever, and I'm like, okay, I think I've seen parts of the third one.
You've never seen the full third one?
I don't know that I've seen all the third one.
Same formula.
Yeah. And then about a third of the way into the new one, I was like, this isn't that great. This is actually pretty crappy. But, like, whatever. Like, it's a disaster. It's a sci-fi movie. I mean, Spielberg, to his credit, and Jaws is one of Mark's favorite movies, and And I like it a lot, and there's a lot of great stuff in it, but I've always brought up, like, you know, Jaws is like the proto sci-fi movie. You got the sheriff on the place with the monster, and the people don't believe it, and then they do, and whatever. And so Spielberg has made a lot of his bones off these, you know, sci-fi original style concepts. Jaws, he just has more money and more
studios. Jaws is very similar to Jurassic Park in that it's the similar format to Jurassic Park, and it also follows the idea that the protagonist and then the protagonists after that are just guys they're adults you don't care about.
Oh, I don't know about that in Jaws. I
think much more so than in Jurassic Park.
What don't much more you so. Care more about the doctor?
Oh, absolutely.
In Jurassic Park than you do about the Brody kids
and stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Who cares about Brody? Would you?
I don't know that I still even care about him, but I think he's more relatable as a person.
How is he more relatable?
Because he's scared of he's trying to get people. Water.
Yeah, but the doctors that they get sent to Jurassic Park are there to, you know, they lays out the thing. I'm going to show you this early so you guys can tell people how great it is because you are the people I need to turn, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
And they're the whole time they're like, no, don't do this. It's a terrible idea. And then they have to escape from the thing that they were correct about. Why is that any less relatable than?
I'm not saying it's not. I mean, I think maybe it's just more scattered because of these other elements that it's trying to do. And in Jaws, it's just more straightforward. You just get. It's maybe subtler. I don't know. I mean, just saying.
I gotta be honest.
Like I could watch that scene.
Jaws is a boring movie.
I could watch the parts of it. I will agree. I don't think it's a perfect movie. But part of that scene with Brody and Richard Dreyfuss's character and Robert Shaw's character on the boat, like, and Robert Shaw does his little speech about the USS Indianapolis scene, and stuff. Yeah. Like if that was flipping on TV, I'm gonna stop and I'm gonna watch that part. The little things where, like, Roy Scheider, like, pours the entire bottle of wine in there because he's, you know... The idea is of some... Here's what it's relatable to me about, and not necessarily relatable, but at least... You have this character who's supposed to do a certain thing, and then the purview kind of extends beyond that. And then, like, it's just very legitimately scary, because it's like, when you're out in the water... You're out of the water. You can't really get escape from this thing. And this thing can go everywhere. No, you're right. Jurassic Park, they're on an island.
They're in a park full of dinosaurs that's malfunctioning.
Yeah, but
how is that less scary than some retards on an ocean with a big shark?
How it malfunctions is just like, I mean, I don't know. Like, yes, when the Tyrannosaurus Rex is chasing after them, okay. Or yes, when the Velociraptors are in the kitchen, that works. But then there's a bunch of them just like, wandering in a field, and then look at this, and then he's bonding with these kids or whatever, and the kids are obnoxious, and who cares?
That's his character arc. He didn't want to have kids, and now he's like, all right.
Now he's like, these kids weren't so bad. Yeah, you know, I guess
exactly. Yeah. That's a character arc in a movie.
I'm sure it was. Yes,
that's all you have to do.
I know. I'm just saying it didn't. So how did JW?
So Jurassic World. Is, you know,
it doesn't really have any of that.
It's okay. No, it's got all the same. It's had the exact same elements in it.
That's right. There are kids in that too. Huh?
So the exact same elements. And
so your boy Trevorrow, who got kicked out of Star
about
Wars
him at all. He whatever, but he executive produced this one.
He didn't direct this one.
No, it was some Indian guy. But so that one was okay. That was like a 3.5. Out of 5, something like that.
Right.
This one...
3.5.
This was great.
And it was a 3.5 out of 5?
Oh, it's a high 3.5.
Okay.
It was the best Jurassic Park movie after the first one.
Better than Lost World?
Oh, I loved it. It was great. I greatly enjoyed
it. I'm seeing really Jurassic terrible World like 2. Star ratings
I
on loved the
Letterboxd. It was... Letterboxd is stupid. Anyone who does it is a moron. It was magnificently suspenseful. It was enjoyable all the way through. It was nonstop. The first half, the first half of it, I guess it is the first half, is amazing and so fast paced. And it mostly has to do with escaping from a volcano exploding island. And it was great. And there were some really well directed moments in there that like this scene that just kind of went nonstop with them trying to escape this thing, and the dinosaurs all around them trying to escape also, and that was amazing. And then the second half is I was so delighted by this, is set in a mansion. It's in a mansion in the woods. And it's, oh, by the way, it's set in Oric,
California. Oric, California?
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Did they shoot any of it in Oric, California?
It didn't look like it, no.
No.
And it was just completely delightful. And it was nonstop suspenseful.
It sounds like...
Sure, and yes, it's stupid, of course.
Right, yeah.
But they're all stupid. You know what I mean?
Right.
So people who were like, right, oh man, it just didn't have the realism of the first
are we,
one.
Are we playing the game again about how it's four children? These are four children.
Here's the thing about that. These, the Jurassic Park movies that makes them better than the Star Wars movies is that, sure, they're for children, but they do a much better job of making it for children. Okay. Star Wars movies are for children, and they do it poorly. Have you ever read... So I've read something recently where George Lucas was talking to... There's a famous conversation with him and Kazdan. And Kazdan was explaining to him what needs to happen in the sequels.
Right.
Not just after Star Wars, so the next ones.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, people have to die, and people need to... you know, there's things that have to happen so that you understand the gravity. And Lucas was like, no. He's like, I don't want anyone to die. He goes, they're supposed to be really, really lightweight things that you go in and you feel great about. That's what Lucas wanted. He goes, I don't want anyone to die. He goes, this is for like little wide-eyed kids. That's what Lucas wanted. And Kazdan somehow convinced him, like, I'm going to take it darker. And he's like, ah.
You're like he got his way for just a little bit for Empire.
Right,
and then
right. Kind of... Yeah, so, but Lucas's vision... Maybe he was right, and maybe he should have just made the little dumb kids movies he wanted to. What's funny is that people worship his vision now. They want it to go back to it. But his vision was, let's have a bunch of teddy bears playing golf together on the moon, like and you know, then they have a picnic. Like that's what he wanted for all of them. He wanted no stakes, like low stakes, where you don't get scared. You don't get like the conversation is crazy. You should look it up. I just saw it for the first time.
It does sound a bit hyperbolic. I'm not sure I completely believe it. If you look at the original Star Wars script, that's pretty high stakes. That's a planet killing thing, and it destroys an entire planet.
The point was, yeah, but you never see anyone on it.
You don't, right?
He purposely made that stuff so it's not that scary or shocking or whatever. Like,
sure,
I don't want to
see
anyone. So anyway. That's what Lucas wanted. So
right.
take his whole thing with a grain of salt. But the Jurassic Park movies are this fantastical idea that's just plausible enough, and then you throw kids in it, actual kids in it,
right.
And you tell them to escape the monster. Like that's perfect, kid and kid at heart adult filmmaking.
Sure.
You know,
so these kids are escaping monsters in a mansion in Oric.
Yes, and it's awesome. It's so great, and it's got. Just the smarmy evil guys,
right.
And
mustache twiddling.
What's his name? Buffalo Bill is like the bad hunter.
Ted Levine.
Guy. Yeah, he's like the bad hunter.
He's the postal waif too.
Yeah, and then like
he wasn't a bad hunter though, because I remember in the movie that he had some complexity. He like wanted that was his thing was to hunt the
in
one.
In two,
yeah, in two.
Oh, but then he had
like a sense of. Ethics and honor.
He had principles. He had principles. Yeah, this guy doesn't have principles. He likes collecting teeth.
Sure.
So he can make a necklace.
Of course.
And there's just...
This is just how that much dumber they've made these
So
movies.
Anyway, as it goes into, in the second half in particular, it absolutely just digs into this thing where it's set in this mansion in the woods, and it's like, you know what, we're just going to go with this.
Right.
We're going to go with it hard. And then it just turns... into this thing where...
So they literally, like, had a bunch of money to make this movie because the other one was so insanely...
Yeah.
And they're like, you know what, let's just do a single location horror plot style thing.
For the second half.
Yeah.
But it's great.
that's a good money-saving approach,
well,
for sure.
It was fantastic. And so
what, did they just have shadows of velociraptors chase them half the time?
So there are some shadow shots, and there's some... And they're just... They're fantastic. They look like... Most of the movie looks like that scene from Running Scared where
right.
The kid keeps seeing the silhouettes
Yes, I know, your favorite.
Of the pedophile kidnappers.
Yes.
Through the whole movie is like that. Or the whole second half of the movie is like that.
The elongated shadows.
It was one of the most For this year by far, the two movies I've seen that this entire year that were the most entertaining were Deadpool 2 and that.
Okay.
Most enjoyment I've had at the theater.
You cannot,
in a very long.
Cannot
time.
Argue somebody out of their enjoyment.
Yeah, it was just, I loved it. I mean, it's how movie making should be. And what's great is you make enough sequels of something, and it makes you disregard how stupid the thing you're watching is now. Because it's been built on the backs of four other pretty stupid, you know,
sure,
ramping down if stupid things. The first one has to be plausible. Here's how we did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then each one, they're like, it just adds more and more to it. So by the time you get to this one, it's just like absolutely.
How close to Gremlins 2 are we at this one? How many steps removed from Gremlins 2?
Is
it the talking ones yet?
They've all been self-referential and stuff. There's pretty smart ones. You know, there's the good guy Raptor, like from Jurassic World, who's basically like a very good, nice dog,
mm-hmm.
but you know, who kills people.
Sure. But bad people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it seems to
know. Wouldn't be the good guy if he killed good know. People.
They're all girls.
Right. Right, that's right.
But it's just fantastic. And for whatever reason, I don't know, even want to know why Goldblum is in there. To lend it what? I don't know.
So is it for the trailer moment?
He's in the pander.
There's a lot of pandering to the original, right?
The bookends, you know? The bookend thing. He talks here, then he talks here.
But then, right.
He says the title of the movie, which is stupid. Right. They always do that.
The titular line?
But I absolutely loved it. It was great.
A whole bunch of mansion running around, huh?
Well, in the second half of it. Well, the first half is on a volcanic exploding island.
Seems like a weird decision. I think you'd reverse that, and you'd have the big volcano set piece be like your big finale.
You could reverse it if you wanted, but why would it matter?
Because you want to end a movie with the most exciting thing, and not like decrease your stakes by having it just be like...
But here's the thing. In the first part of it, the people who are escaping are Chris Pratt... And what's her name?
Bryce Dallas Howard.
And then a couple other people. But then when they get back to the mansion, there's a kid.
Uh-huh.
So the stakes are increased, you see.
Because
the kid has to live.
Right.
Unless so who cares if they die on the island? No big loss, right?
They're your big stars.
They've already had sex.
They have to live.
This girl hasn't yet, as far as I know. If she had, that'd be a really dark subplot. That,
ew.
You know, she's like 11 or something.
Is she good at everything?
She has a secret.
What's her secret?
Well, she doesn't. She, the secret.
Spoiler alert!
The secret is being kept from her. I'm not going to tell it. I won't spoil it. Because you need to watch it. It's a great movie.
Right. Yeah, no, I'll watch it when it comes on HBO or something in 2 years.
I think you should turn this off right now. Go drive down to the theater and watch it right now.
Mm.
No?
Nah. I'm more of a cinemaphile these days. So unless it's The English Patient... It falls under the made for kids category, and you can't really apply like critical criticism to things.
It was more Spielbergian than
Munich.
Oh, much more. It was like his old Spielberg movies. It was zany action.
Okay,
you know, like this is great.
If it was fun and you had a good time, I'm gonna argue with you on that.
You can't argue with me. You haven't seen it.
I know.
You're taking the words of the
No. I'm taking your word. Describing it.
Which is weird because usually, as a contrarian, you take what the intelligentsia does and then look for a reason why you should like something.
Letterboxd
instead.
Isn't necessarily the intelligentsia, and I am kind of turning around on your Sicario 2 thing here because I think it probably has a lot to do with people. Being angry there's not a female lead, but who knows?
No, that's the misogynist in you looking for
of course, yes.
Which is, so let me guess.
The contrary.
Not a Last Jedi guy?
Oh, right. I saw that poster you retweeted.
Yeah, wasn't that funny?
Yeah, where it's like, well, you know, like anyone that's critical.
And it showed his origin. What's her name on there is in the kitchen making some food or something like that? Yeah.
Like that was really what people, that was really what
was,
the majority of the criticism
was,
of that
old,
movie was based
old
on.
Carrie Fisher in the bikini again.
Yeah.
That was funny.
Oh my God. What a stupid sort of tangent that so much discussion of stories has gotten into. Unfortunate. Back when we started this in 2007, we didn't have to worry about that kind of shit. Not that we worry about it now.
I don't know. I mean, do you think in that amount of time, you think in 11 years, it's movies have gotten worse?
I don't think they've gotten worse. No, I think that there's more
like
stuff.
You think storytelling has changed? Like
not necessarily. I think I don't think anything has really shifted. I think there's good things about the fact that people are looking to have a greater diversity in the cast and in the kind of heroic stories they tell.
I just think that stuff is irrelevant.
It is because ideally it is,
Right.
If I write a story and I sit down and write a story, I hardly waste any time describing the ethnicity of the character. And I really don't care too much about the gender. I just need to have a pronoun that I can use. And if I'm writing it with some kind of a male perspective, I don't feel like it's, authentic to make it just decide to call it, make it a woman later on. I would have to think about it more because there are realistic things to consider when you're writing stories. My biggest criticism of the newer Star Wars movies, I think, is that they seem to kind of cling on to this unfortunate sort of idea where like, if you're critical of it, it's because of this. It's like, no.
Oh, yeah.
We've talked about this before.
Straw man arguments.
There's a lot of major straw man argument or straw woman in this case.
Yeah, yeah.
And the problem is, like, no. I mean, I'm all for. I mean, the first... And really, here's the thing. There's been, quote-unquote, strong female characters in good movies for fucking years. Mm. If you look back at old movies from the 30s, like film noirs and things, the Bette Davis movies and stuff, I mean, no, maybe she's a femme fatale, and that means she's not a good guy or whatever. But you have all kinds of movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, back in the, sexist heyday of Hollywood, right? And then even something like, talking about Ridley Scott with Alien, where Ripley,
Absolutely.
And,
right.
and it isn't about that, well, you said, because it should be irrelevant, and that's the biggest thing.
The thing is, what you're trying to say is, so if there are stories about women, stories about people of a particular race, then that's what those things are about. But when you take something that's not about any of those in particular, and you try to shoehorn those things into them to make them so that they are like the thing we're used to, except for now roles have been switched. So because you're forcing the gender issue and the race issue into a picture that nobody asked for, like where it just doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter in a story, in like a big fantastic sci-fi action thing.
I mean, it might not. I mean, in some cases, it might. And there are relevant things to be addressed in certain things, historically or whatever else, I think, that have to be done. You can't, just ignore something like slavery and have some...
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I mean, in terms of if you're doing a Western or something. But.
I think one of the issues is, I think there's probably no shortage of stuff being written about those types of people. Different ethnicities... genders, etc. But the buck stops at the studio heads.
Right, but
they're choosing what gets made.
And a lot of those studio heads are female, are women. That's always been the thing. People are like, oh, right, yeah. I mean, who's the big Star Wars one now? Kathleen Kennedy,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
Not that she's a studio head necessarily. I don't know what
right.
she is, but I mean...
She's in charge of the Lucasfilm.
Right, yeah. So I mean, we're kind of diving into a weird tangent.
Well,
main thing was with the Rey character in the Star Wars movies, and it was not so bad in the second one, I'll admit it. It's just, if you're going to tell a story that is based on like a children's story, it's supposed to be for kids, it's got to be a fable, it's about the hero's journey, then your hero has to start from a place of being more like a child, more just like Luke Skywalker did. He was more of a whiny teenager that really was, I mean, he was already had some natural gifts as a pilot that were explained through, messing around with his friends. But
this
you didn't have Luke's
bitter work.
It always does. It's important. It's an important part of the hero's journey.
So you don't like that Rey didn't have to do any bitter work
at all, and not even the second one.
None. She had none.
I mean, here's the thing. By the end of Return of the Jedi,
she's startled to find that she has those abilities.
Yeah, and then she's good at them immediately. So what do you sort of, getting a big picture about it, what are you teaching young girls and young boys and young people? Same with the Harry Potter movies and things, which is maybe less relevant. when you just say the hero that you're supposed to identify in this story, this hero is just good at it already and is just born, is just the one. And right. doesn't have to go through... Even in The Matrix, they say you're the one, but yeah. then they play back and forth, and he has doubt, and he has to overcome right. that. There's no sense of overcoming anything, struggling or anything, in these new ones. And so it becomes just this kind of, like, feel-good pander fest. And that's what I have a problem with. Because I don't think that that's a good thing to teach young kids.
Well, my
is that, hey, guess what? You're just going
to,
like, be good
to
at
that.
Everything.
Would be that...
You can say it's a dumb movie for kids, and they shouldn't take it seriously.
My counter to that would be that... I think it's problematic to teach people that hard work pays off, because it doesn't. What your work and your effort in life means absolutely nothing.
Well, that's
most
a fairly cynical take.
Most of those people die in the ditch. It's
you can play that as well, but the other side of it isn't necessarily even about the hard work. It's about a focus and a struggle to improve things for yourself, and the realization that nobody starts off good at anything. You're not just born good at stuff. It's not all raw talent, and you're not the one. And if you have a whole generation of kids that come up thinking that, and then thinking that the only way they're either going to give up on life when they can't do something good in 5 minutes.
I don't think they should give up on life, but I mean, people.
Well, what are they going
to
do?
People should be fighting to change a system that keeps you down no matter what, unless you're born into something.
Sure, but the saying somebody's just born good at something is the same problem.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. But that's been an old archetype. It's the magical sure. person who's born who has powers, like
possibly. Yeah, and it is in the first Star Wars. It's talk of the Skywalker lineage and everything.
Right.
You have this, but you don't realize it. But he has to. You have to go through doubt. You have to go through. Failure, you have to go through everything.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we all are born and told we're special or we're not, but we have to feel that way because we're the only thing that we can perceive the universe through. And then we just get up and we do what we can. And yeah, there are all kinds of dramas and stories about the person that tries really hard and fails, or how luck plays into things, or the person who started with everything and ended up in the gutter, and the person who started with nothing and ended up succeeding. And these things happen in real life too. Regardless of whether or not, you know, you think communism is a better system than capitalism, I mean...
I don't think anyone has ever started with nothing and ended up with anything. I mean, no matter what, it's always...
Well, there's luck, too. There's being in the right place at the right time. There's having the friend of the friend who... that gets you a connection.
Right.
But you have to be there doing the work, too. You know, like, you can't just write one story... And then your neighbor happens to be, like, the... assistant to the assistant, and they get you that story, and hooray, you're off.
See,
and
now,
running.
That's where I think that The Last Jedi did that interesting thing where I'll agree with you that, you know, her grasp of powers is way too strong and that all that stuff. But they made a point of taking that whole magical lineage birthright thing and saying, by the way, you know, they tore that away from the
Yeah,
story,
but they did
right?
that in the mystery box horseshit way, where, like, it'll get rewritten or changed.
You
don't
know
if he means it.
You don't know. But for right now, it is what it is, which is she's not from some special line.
Well, then, where we're at right now, the last one from the special line would be, what's his name? Right? Because
Kylo Ren?
Yeah, well, and then, because what's your name is going to have to be dead at the beginning of the first one. They're gonna have
Solo?
To,
yeah. I wonder how they're going to do that.
They're just going to have to write it off. They could have very easily taken care of it in this one because they essentially killed her, but then they had to have her her magical moment, which is another thing where it adds another level of, like, maybe that wasn't her thing, and that they'd kind of established that that wasn't her thing.
I didn't have a problem with that at all.
I don't have a huge problem with it. I just think it's, like, okay. Like, you start to dilute these things by...
In fact, I think it would be weird if they never...
If she didn't have any sort of,
you know, she could already feel things through the Force,
right?
So she could probably manifest it in other ways. You know,
it was just a case of deciding all of a sudden at that point to
the
have
fact that
do
she
something.
Could keep herself alive and float through space was dumb.
Yeah,
I don't. We've never
that
known
was
that
a dumb
that
way
was,
to. That was a dumb way
once
to.
Once again,
emphasize
once
that.
Again, we're taking something that's made up and retarded and complaining that it's not the way we want it to be made up and retarded. So that's relevant.
Right, but that's what all of movie criticism is. Even The English Patient.
I don't even remember what happens.
No, but it's the go-to bullshit Oscar-batory example of, you know, something that's dramatic and fanciful. That's it's a joke. But it's like saying, this thing these movies, they're all made for kids. They're all made for people to sit down and pretend they're real, but they're not. So if you're going to talk about them with any legit sense of criticism, then you want to talk about them based on, like, a validity of characterization and what they do as a story, how they function in the culture to, you know, convey a lesson or, you know.
Right.
But, yeah, and yes, you can also have something that's just as straightforward as a quote-unquote thrill ride. It can just be Apocalypto and as a chase movie, you know. That's fine.
That's a good movie. But I just wish that 40-year-old men weren't giving Star Wars so much credit. They're taking this thing that was never big, or that was never smart and never supposed to hold up to these logical things, and they're complaining when it progresses.
I feel like that's kind of a straw man too, and I don't know what the progress is. Is the progress okay? Because you start to contradict yourself when you say there are four kids when somebody complains about one thing.
Yeah.
But then, like, but look at the brave choices that were made in the new one. Like, look at how Benicio del Toro's character represents a character that points out the kind of like ambivalence of war and the fact that you can profit from the good side and the bad side. It's like, that's not a storyline for kids.
There were brave choices.
Well, that's just, the other thing.
Just but the storyline has progressed in a way that wasn't expected at times. Some things happened that weren't expected, and I would think that's what fans would want out of it. I would think as an extreme fan of a franchise, you wouldn't want it to do exactly what you think it's going to do.
Right, but the thing is, I think with certain things, especially because they're part of a franchise. You have this sort of weird paradoxical argument, right? Where you've got...
I mean, I'll give you that I was pissed at what happened with the fourth Indiana Jones. That felt like a horrible betrayal.
And disingenuous.
Right? So I can understand it in that aspect. I just can't understand it with the Star Wars movies. I just can't get people's ire.
Well, okay. I mean...
I get it from Indiana Jones.
I've revisited the fourth Indiana Jones, and it's not the worst thing in the world, whatever. And I mean, neither of these Star Wars movies are either.
Right.
It's really tough to... You have to just give thing a few years, you know, because people are so fucking hyperbolic. Yeah, yeah, and then they're strawman about it. They're like, oh, well, you're critical of it? Well, that's because you're a racist and a sexist and you're a 40-year-old guy that lives in your mom's basement and you take it too seriously, but then you don't, you know, understand that this is how the culture goes. And it's like, whoa, maybe I just thought it could have been... This seems a little weird.
The problem is that there were people being racist and sexist.
I'm sure
And the people who want to complain about them take those few and put them as the face.
Right.
Of the people who
there's always somebody threatening to kill somebody on the internet, and then that means, oh my god, we're at red alert for any kind of critique. And then it's like, okay, well then I just shrug and I won't engage. And
there's a difference between saying you didn't care for something,
right,
and calling for the reversal of
course,
you know, like that's insane.
No,
what they're doing is just, I mean, it's because they have so much of their entire lives and personhood invested in this thing that they grew up with.
It's problematic. I'm not going to say it's not. But I think... Yeah, and I'm not even sure where we were going with this, but it was just...
And Jurassic Park movies.
Yeah, the Jurassic Park movies. And just...
I feel like the pure escapism of those...
Right.
Works better than the pure escapism of the Star Wars movies because they're simpler when it comes down to. They're all about escape.
Sure.
You know, like, in each one is about the same thing. Put themselves in a situation they shouldn't because they're
monster movies.
They're trying to overreach their grasp. You know, the it always starts with somebody trying to take something with this thing that they shouldn't have made anyway.
Trying to control nature.
Exactly. You put it in the place of a bad guy trying to do something, and then misguided people coming in and like, oh, maybe I could help, maybe I could do a good thing with this. And then disaster happens and you have to escape. And at the end, they learn their lesson, right?
Yeah.
So that's the basic thing there.
And the cynicism and the kind of letdown of the conclusion of the first movie, the first Jurassic Park, does kind of go towards that. And does kind of, I think, make it, in a weird way, kind of a more... mature conclusion to a story, because
sure,
you're left with like,
yeah,
we survived this, and yeah, it didn't turn into a big, like, jumped away from an explosion, but what's going to happen now? This just didn't work, and it's sad. It's a sad movie at the end. And the music, the little John Williams music, is no longer bombastic and exciting. It's a downer, honestly. Because when you see that first Brontosaurus or whatever they're calling him now.
Brachiosaurus.
Is that? I'm not sure. Whatever. Yeah. And then you're like, wow, this is awesome. Wow, look at what we're accomplishing. And then it ends up becoming a pretty cynical story about, like, yeah, but we shouldn't have done that.
And that's always been the message in there. And, you know, in fact, in this one, it's Goldblum once again harping on it.
Right.
And there's a funny, it's not even funny, it's kind of, there's several characters that take the mindset throughout this movie where they say, it's like, it's time to let him die.
Yeah.
And it's the good guys.
Yeah.
And several of the good guys at different parts are like, let it happen, you know? And, but at the same time, you're like, It's not these creatures' fault, whatever.
Sure.
You know, it puts itself in that gray area and asks you to kind of understand both viewpoints, which is neither here nor there about real life at all. Well, but you know what? We're getting close to that. They probably could make a dinosaur right now. Who knows? You know?
Robot dinosaurs?
They've already cloned everything else.
Artificial intelligence.
They can clone human organs. So we're in that. We're getting to that area now.
It's good old school Twilight Zone style sci-fi ideas, which is, you can do this thing, but what happens when it goes awry and turns out it was man, you know?
And you know what people used to say about the Star Wars thing being a space opera thing holds true, I guess, in that the storyline, you know, the word epic is so overused, but it's an epic.
Yes.
It's an epic about, you know, an empire, an actual empire, and the certain entities wanting to change that. So it's got this grand scope and scale, interplanetary even. So the idea behind it, you know, as the space opera thing, is absolutely true. And so I can see where, I can see where people could invest themselves more in that. I mean, it's not just inventing a scenario, but it's inventing an entire universe that you can get lost in. And there is so much depth. One of the things that Lucas did so well was give the reins to all these different people in different facets so that there would be toys and video games and comic books and things that grew this world into something where if you invest in it, you'll never leave.
Sure.
And the rest of your life you're going to be buying his product.
And Jimmy Cam did it in one movie.
What do you mean?
Well, aren't people like getting, like, you know, Prozac prescriptions after watching Avatar because they never wanted to leave Pandora?
Is that real?
Stuff? That was like a news story where like people getting depression from.
That movie sucked so bad. I can't believe they're making like five more of those.
Yeah, it was not the best.
So weird. Four more.
I don't know. It's something like that. That's what he's going to end his career with, is doing that. Probably.
I just don't know his career,
but I mean, like, he's what else is he going to spend his time doing? Yeah. He hasn't done anything since then.
I just don't get it. It's so weird to me.
Yeah, I know. We could have had, like, another True Lies and maybe another...
he's
another
guy,
original, like, something from
he's
him.
Another guy who's had high highs and then has chosen just such strength. You know, what's funny is that his greatest successes have come from things like Titanic, which I'm sure you and I just both think is like, eh. I'm just not into...
It's a melodrama.
When it comes to it, down to it, it's a disaster film, but it's a romance.
And no, the first half of it is a romantic melodrama, and the second half is a disaster action movie, and that half is actually James Cameron movie because it's
sure.
James
Cameron. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
And the first half is
I just didn't care for it.
Yeah, I didn't care for it. I've seen it once. It's long. I don't care about the romantic stuff. I get bored with a lot of things. I mean, I don't get bored. I'll admit. You know, you give me a gritty, hard-boiled detective story in a science fiction spectacle world that's got that extra bit, I can kind of just watch that stuff again.
Yeah.
And I can watch a guy move like a weird thing and, like, you know, look for like a fiber under a couch.
I can't.
And,
too,
you know, with like a Zeppelin in the background. I can watch that sort of shit constantly, but you still have to give me like interesting characters and a good storyline there, because then it's Moon 44 or it's whatchamacallit, it's Mute, and then I get more indignant about that, you know?
Yeah, right.
Or it's fucking Sucker Punch and it's like, there's an awesome train, but then whatever, you know? Like, I mean, and you can argue movies into satire and like, oh, look at these weird decisions that were made, and like somebody could sit down on the internet, there could be a YouTube video made about that, like, oh, this is actually really good if you view it from this point of view, and it's like, Yeah, but I don't want to view it from that point of view. And I just don't want to watch it again.
You know, it's funny how you can intellectually trick yourself into thinking something is different than how you first perceived it. But when it comes down to it, the most honest
right
your honest initial reaction to something, you know, that was your animalistic response. You know,
I mean, if it wasn't
something where you can intellectually sit down and try to convince yourself. I mean, there are things that grow on you, but that's right. Different.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's like seeing Synecdoche, New York, and missing a bunch of little subtle things, like how time moves in that movie and stuff. I mean, there's also, I think, how somebody sees something. I mean, a lot of the guys in the Film Junk podcast, a lot of their first viewings of certain things, like something like Speed Racer, was like at the drive-in, and it's like, oh, you could see it was colorful, but I'd like to actually sit down and watch this on a Blu-ray or at home when it's not on a big screen, you know, outside where the colors are duller. Your experience of your theatrical experience or cinematic experience plays a big part, as I've mentioned many times. And you're right, but I do agree that if something is something that's good, in your opinion, it would be really hard for you to see it as bad, even with a lot of things working against it. You would still give it, like, you'd file it away. I mean, the same thing was with me and Blade Runner. I watched it with a friend one night, hanging out when we were kids, and we sort of stopped it in the middle. We got kind of bored with it, and I think I finished it the next morning on my own.
Yeah.
And then I watched it a couple more. I always kind of filed away, you know. I kind of force fed because of those superficial aspects of it. And then you start to get those other deeper things going on, and you're like, oh wow, this actually. And then it becomes a richer meal or whatever.
You're right. It is. I think you could trick yourself into thinking something is good if you didn't like it the first time. And in fact, you could watch something later on and change your viewpoint. But it's very difficult when...
You have to want to watch it a second time.
Sure.
And so, which means you already have to kind of be inclined to thinking it's good. I don't think there's anything I've revisited. Like, I'm never going to watch anything again. That's why my standard deviation on Letterboxd or something is the way it is. Because, one, I'm very prejudicial. Like, I'm... unapologetically racially, so, yeah, all about it, and and, you know, so yeah, if you trick me with your trailer that says, oh look, it's got these cool superficial things in it that I like, then I'm like, okay, maybe I'll check that out, and maybe it'll be better than I think it will. But nah, 2 out of 5, you know, whatever. That's why I don't have a lot of 1 out of 5s, because I'm just like, I'm not even gonna bother if, like, you know,
prejudice. Is there anything that's a 1 out of 5, really? I mean, that's
I mean, I think the lowest rating I've been given in all 400 episodes of this podcast, and I was going to revisit it because I'm thinking I might bump it.
I'm sure I've given stuff 1.
Was The Spirit.
That was pretty bad.
But I think if I watched it again in the right context, I would be a little less like...
Now,
because it's a very goofy movie,
but I
don't remember there
being... I agree that that might be something just because of the genre
and the context, how
it was shot and everything, that I would be, even if it was just absolute and utter shit, that I would be like, I could try watching that again.
Right.
But there are many movies that I might have given a 3 to that I would never try to watch again because it's just not something I'm interested in.
Well, like you talk about, like the idea, a lot of movies, I mean, good movies, they're bummers.
Yeah.
I see it once, I get the joke. You know, that's always been my cynical
take. Yeah, there's no reason to rewatch some sort of hard-hitting drama.
Right, yeah, you know.
There's never a reason.
I feel like that, maybe it's ethnocentric or Eurocentric or whatever, but I think a lot of, like, the quote-unquote European movies that are, you know, like the Henneke type of stuff, where it's like, oh, you know, snooty horse shit, you know, like, it's like, yeah, I get it, okay, dude, you know, I only need to watch 10 minutes
of this. If there's some sort of dark twist to it, I might...
A dark twist, maybe?
Because Henneke's always dealt with dark twists.
Sort of, but he's up his own ass pretty bad, too.
Well, and they all and are.
That's not fair. I mean, like, someone...
There's no directors who aren't up their own ass.
That's okay, you know what? That's a better way. That just Jim say it about everybody. But I was just, I rewatched Drive here recently, and and I've seen Neon Demon. And did you see Neon Demon?
I never watched it.
I just want to know what the people that
really... I never watched that other one he did with Gosling, either.
That was Only God Forgives. Yeah. I didn't get much out of that one either. I feel like, in a weird way, like he just went too obtuse or something. And with Neon Demon,
he was
like,
already obtuse, though.
Right? But Drive is like a movie.
Drive is more accessible, but
it's a straightforward plot.
But it's not a straightforward plot. And the stakes just keep getting lower and lower and lower. And it doesn't do things in a traditional story manner. And it's weird. It is the most accessible of his films that I've seen. So that's the entry point into it. I enjoy it, and that's right. One that I always think, man, I need to watch that again. But by the time I get to the end of it, I'm always like, man, that second half was just kind of lame.
I don't know. I feel like it has a pretty natural flow from a noir standpoint. You know, you get involved in something, things get used to, the stakes get lower. I think the stakes get higher.
I feel like
because people it starts to be like, okay, now somebody's going to kill somebody,
right? But somebody has
been killed.
But what I'm saying is the way the action throughout the film de-escalates to the point where eventually he's drowning a guy in the ocean, and each action scene gets less violent, less fast, less loud, and more just the inevitability of him coming to get somebody.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm sure that was meaningful. I'm sure he meant it to be that way for whatever reason. But that's just not as exciting from a filmic standpoint, from a film-watching standpoint, I don't think.
I guess. I mean, I think for me, it's one of those things where every 5 years I'll revisit it because I just won't remember the minutiae of the plot. I'll remember that I think he dies at the end, but I don't really know. And I
choose to think he doesn't.
Right. Well, he was stabbed inside. It's one of those Spike Spiegel shot.
If you wing somebody, they live.
Yeah.
He was winged.
Yeah, and it was nighttime. It was daytime. Sunset when he got stabbed, so he'd been bleeding for a good long time.
It's probably fine. He's driving away.
It was super. What's this? This is just a goddamn flesh wound. What are you wasting my time for, this flesh wound?
Yeah. That was awesome. I love Last Action Hero.
You cannot go wrong.
We were talking about that the other day. That's
LAH.
That's the type of movie that, you know, sometimes movies about movies can be good. You know, and there's generally something where, like, the player is good. There's a lot of movies that are about movies that are good, and there's some that are probably not so good, but like State and Main, The Player, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Like, most of those, one of the reasons why those work is because if you watch a lot of movies, you understand tropes, you understand the business, you read about the business, you hear about the behind the scenes things. And so it's not necessarily so inside baseball because there's no group that would willingly watch a movie about movies who doesn't understand the way movies work, right? So it's not like they're telling you it's not presenting a film about a particular thing to a vast audience of people who can't understand why they were being forced to watch this thing. The people who go to see movies about movies know about movies.
Right. I mean, but I think there's also, beyond that, there's just the idea that, like, I mean, okay, so another example of a movie about movies is Inception. And it, you know, a heist movie. I mean, it's this thing where it's about this idea of, like, you get a team together and you create this world and you manifest this storyline and this narrative, and there has to be these action sequences because there needs to be this manipulation. I mean, I haven't watched that in a while, and it's definitely a good one. I've been wanting to rewatch it. One of my favorite movies of the last 10 years. You talk about that, I have that same exact effect, with the exception being The Prestige. Of almost every time I've gone to a Christopher Nolan movie, the first experience of it in the cinema has been blowing me away. Yeah. You know, I mean, even Interstellar, I think was a lesser, revisited it yet. But with it, and then
I think we talked about that. We did, with Interstellar. That as time went by, I could feel that I was going to be less impressed with it. But having come out of the theater, I was blown away.
See, and now for Prestige, it took like the second viewing for me to kind of get over.
It's a different film.
Yeah, it's different. Yeah,
it's much less about spectacle and more about.
Right, it's more of a revenge story, and not as much. And I think I wanted it to be more of a steampunk spectacle movie, and less of a. Still a great movie, though.
It's great,
But I wanted to revisit it. I had this in my mind where, you know, like, this isn't. There's something I want to check that out again. And sometimes that is just for superficial reasons, like, oh, there's a couple of cool scenes in it. It'd be worth seeing again.
You think Inception is about movies?
Well, there's an argument to be made about how anytime something is... a lot of big heist movies are kind of a metaphor for getting together and making a movie. Ocean's 11. They have to create... I mean, literally, there's a scene that's like the artifice of movies, right? Where there's the guy... Somebody's watching something happen on a screen and is drawn into it, but it's not real. And it's all part of this game that these tricksters pull together, and they got one over on him, and they got one over on us, the audience. It's like a double reflection or something, you know?
Well, I mean, so in that way...
But the point is, I'm saying that it's not just like you have to love movies so much to be into a movie that's explicitly about making movies. It's the idea of people, a team, an ensemble, getting together to build or create something. And that's what a heist is, and that's what, you know, all kinds of movies that are about that kind of thing. I think that's always a lot of fun to watch. I'm trying to think of things other than heist movies or movies about making movies. I mean, there's not a lot of that, you know. It's not like, you know, oh, this is a movie, you know. Documentaries do that a lot because it's about,
right.
You know, maybe it's a documentary about, like, a bunch of Amish people building a barn. And, you know, and that can be, that might sound boring, but it might be really compelling to see, like, them create something, you know? So you think that people are dishonest?
I think people are tricking themselves into not liking things that are purely entertaining, movie-wise.
Not everybody. You're talking about critical pretense, kind of?
There's a critical pretense to the reason why...
Okay, well, let me just try to find a person, like... I don't know anything from him, but you have Bill Simmons, right? He does movie stuff too.
Does he kind of have people do movie stuff for him?
Right, right.
But his taste in movies is exactly Seth's. He loves Money Train. He loves Roadhouse.
Sure, but then he probably also likes real movies too.
He never talks about real movies ever.
Right. I mean, he likes real in quotes because, like, whatever, they're all.
Yeah, he's only ever talks about Rounders, Roadhouse, and Money Train.
Okay. that's pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like it's that sort of thing. Like, I'm sure he's seen the other things, but he doesn't talk about it.
Right.
He's interested in a type of movie. He's interested in big, dumb action films.
Okay.
Right? What do you think there's a dishonesty about?
I think people trick themselves into I'm always surprised when certain friends of mine. This doesn't happen with you because you're predictable. I can tell what you're going to like and don't like.
But
Ryan, for instance, it's very strange. Something will be just great, and I'll come out of it and be like, man, that was so entertaining and good. And he's like, oh, man, that sucked. And I have to think about the reason why. Like, he really, like, I, you know, all the recent Star Wars movies... Except for Solo. Now, Solo wasn't great.
No.
But I appreciated it. And after I saw it the second time, I appreciated it even more. And his instant reaction was that it was just utter trash. But I think he's had that reaction... I think he falls really into the nostalgia thing. So he's had that reaction with anything that is made off of a childhood property that he loved. I think, especially men... They reach a certain age, and it's not necessarily him. I don't even know why I mentioned him. But he hasn't liked any of the Star Wars things. I think anyone who did not like this Jurassic Park movie thought... that it should have been. That's the issue. People are thinking things should be something else. They're not watching something for what it is and just letting it wash over them. They're approaching these movies in a way where they expect something to happen because it's part of a franchise they've invested themselves in, like I said. And then it's not doing what they wanted it to do, which is not the point of movies.
Right.
They're not there as wish fulfillment for you. They are there to tell their story in a way that makes you... You know what's a great response to something you watch? Disgust. That means it did its job.
Okay, yeah.
It pisses you off.
I understand.
It's meant to manipulate your emotions in one way or another. So... I mean, I would argue that everything that Ryan has seen, for instance, our friend, that infuriates him, did a good job. Because...
Well, it elicited some kind of strong emotion.
It did not do what he wanted it to do. I know too many people who come out of a movie and go, it should have done this, it should have done that. That is such a horseshit response to a movie.
Okay, I'll give you that. And I'll admit that I'm definitely guilty of that. I think that there's a balancing act with franchise.
That, but you do that in from a filmmaker's corner. You don't. I don't think you do that as a fan so much.
Well, no. I mean, but I do it with I think a transparency. Like I said earlier about Prestige, I wanted it to be a little bit of a different thing. Because here's what happens with movies a lot, right? I mean, especially in our group of people, like not necessarily in our group of people necessarily, but just they make these trailers and everyone's like, "Oh my god, that trailer looks so awesome," or whatever. You know, not that we're running around doing that, but I mean. They sell a movie based on a trailer, which means that they contrive a certain kind of thing out of it, you know? And then when you go see it, excited based on the ideas you think it's hinting at. Okay, I'll give you a good example. For me, Spike Jonze's Where the Wild Things Are.
Mm-hmm.
In the trailer for that, it looked like it was like a kid adventure movie. And then it ends up being a lot of navel-gazing, yeah. You know, yammering about what it means to grow up or something, you know, and it was just like, this isn't what I wanted in this movie. I wanted, like, to be the escapism of a kid's movie. And right. You're right, no, it might not be a terrible movie, but I was just like, that wasn't...
It was weird.
That was weird. I mean, you liked it at the time, and I didn't.
Yeah, no, I gave it an okay... I was writing for the paper at that point. I probably gave it a 3.
Something like that. And to me, it was just like... And I was also going into it having a friend of mine... sort of basically say the same thing to me about it, but I was still, having seen the trailer, thinking, oh, this friend probably wants it to be something more like what it was, but it sounded like, you know,
I think
no.
Trailers can only do... I think...
They can't usually do... They can usually screw stuff up.
Yeah, if it wasn't an issue of money, I would say get rid of trailers and everyone should go into anything blind.
I try to as best as I can. Because something like Killing of a Sacred Deer, I went into it, I think, as blind as it could. I think I had seen a couple...
I try to do that mostly these days. I mean, I don't attempt to. I just don't see many... and you know what's... And honestly, I mean, I'll see a trailer for something I don't even know is coming out, and I'm like, whoa. You know? So, I mean, so that's what its job is to do, is to make you pay. They don't care what you think about it once
exactly.
You but it does a disservice to the film... If they, like, just like you said, if they set it up to be something, the problem with Where Wild Things Are is that it had the Arcade Fire song on the trailer.
Right. And the song made it seem very big and adventurous.
Big and adventurous and fun and all that stuff. And
the shots they chose were these, like, epic wide shots of, like the 2 seconds of actual adventure on the boat or whatever. Right. And you're like, oh, wow, it's going to be like that. Another good one. Benjamin Button. They show like the tugboat. They show him in when he's younger and he's like motorcycling through China, which is like just like a throwaway shot at the end.
Right.
And then it ends up being this like kind of like tedious romance that's sort of like an awful. She's kind of awful to him, and you're just like there was a it was an okay movie and it, as a drama in places. It was overlong, but all that kind of adventure stuff that you see in the trailer, you're thinking, oh wow, what an interesting idea. This person who starts off old and then as he becomes older, as he gains experience in life, his body is able to, you know, is young.
Right.
You know, imagine being 20 years old body with like an 80-year-old mind, and then all the things that could be done with that. And they didn't do shit with that idea in the movie. It didn't matter that he was aging backwards. It just ended up becoming this dramatic
just thing. It ended up being the weight of relationships.
Which if you hadn't seen that trailer, maybe you wouldn't have gotten as into it.
And that's what I was just going to say was, if you hadn't seen the World of Wild Things Are trailer, you might have gone into it and been like, wow, that was weird and interesting. And you might have given it a decent score.
I might have,
You know?
I mean, exactly. And I'm generally pretty honest
about
that.
And it is
that.
Weird and interesting, but it's not anything like... you think it's going to be. So if you set yourself up for something, it's not going to happen. So,
and
yeah,
and I'm trying my best not to set myself up. I mean, I want to have a sense of what kind of movie I'm going to see because it depends on mood, as I've always said before, I'm not, and I agree, you're right, a really well-made movie, if you're in a shitty mood and, you know, you watch a comedy, you're going to laugh. If it's good, if it's a good comedy, it's going to pull you out of the funk. I don't know, though. Maybe not always. But yeah, getting to this idea of... I think you're doing a bit of what I've been guilty of in the past, which is trying to kind of prescribe other people's tastes, based on your own assumptions
here's the thing.
I think people do.
I, you know, I know, and you're like this as well. We're both cinematically very intelligent. We have a very high intelligence quotient about movies.
One thing for me, yes. I couldn't fix a car.
So, we understand when something is good or bad or why or more about that. And when, not necessarily a majority or a consensus is different from what we think, but a very loud section, a subset of people,
right,
have made it very clear they don't like something that you or I enjoy or whatever, I have to think there is an issue in interpretation. There's an issue, and what I've been thinking lately is it's people wanting what they have seen to have been something else. But that is not the problem of the filmmaker. That's a you problem. That's a viewership problem. And
well,
so
I mean, you're getting it like this. It's like the whole thing with like being a comedian, right? You know, like is it your fault the audience didn't laugh, or did they just not get the joke? I mean, at some level, you're creating a product for someone to consume.
But that's the thing is that with a
and these big blockbusters are ideally supposed to be giving you what
sure.
you want. But the thing is, you want something that will give you what you want, but in a way is unexpected. So, you know, that's where twists come in. That's where like a different play on the idea of something comes in, or like, you know, oh wow, I didn't expect that it was going to be such an, or I didn't know that this side character was going to have such a major part to play, and then was really funny, and so it was like, you know, but it still worked. It doesn't undermine what you're going into it expecting necessarily. It bolsters it, but it does it in novel and interesting ways that are authentic to like the elements of drama.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's what, you know, we've talked many times about the fact that there's no new ideas, there's nothing original. All you can do is tweak and subvert.
Right. Or genre blend.
The formulas that currently exist. So people go into a movie wanting it to be a particular thing. And so maybe I'm not being fair about that. Everyone does that. But when it's a particular, you know, it's because people subconsciously, even the dumbest people, understand story structure. And so if something is really weird,
I think that even the dumbest people understand when something doesn't work.
Yeah, because subconsciously the structure, they're getting
the logic didn't hit.
There is a logical narrative, you know, the whole Aristotle thing, like, it, you know, it's set up
sure.
to work a certain way, and it's not like he invented that. He just found a way to put into words, you know.
And the current current failure of the fifth Transformers movie might be pointing towards that. I've not made myself watch it yet, but it sounds like they just finally did too much of the dumb stuff without any kind of a logical narrative, and it's just like people were out.
I need to watch that.
Yeah, it's on streaming now. But okay, and here's a good case in point. We could do a case study sort of thing about the, like, giving you what you wanted, but in unexpected ways or whatever, and it being amazing. The Dark Knight. Mm. Batman 2. Christopher Nolan does his first Batman Begins. A lot of people hold, hey, the second half is sort of just a dumb superhero movie, but the first half he's doing all these interesting things about the idea of the character, and I agree. I think, I don't have a problem with the second half because I'm a Batman comic book fan, whatever. So now I'm all set up as a comic book fan. I remember the trailer for that actually worked in the opposite way for me because they chose things like him on the motorcycle, which is always dumb. The bat cycle is always the stupidest thing because of the cape, and it just looks dumb. It looks stupid. And like he's like peeling out in like a city street, and the Joker's like, come on, get me. And I'm like, is this what this is going to be? It's going to be the Joker going, come on, get me. And Batman on the motorcycle doing like tricks, like doing Brodies or whatever they call it. It's going to be a Mission Impossible 2 of Batman. And then I went in, and it's like, and you know, and what's with these skyscraper shots? And like, this doesn't feel like it's not shot dark. It's daytime.
Right.
It's hardly any dialogue. What's going on? You're seeing the backs of people. Like, okay. And so that was, you know, but you still got, you know, a comic book story about Batman because Batman is a crime fighter. And so, like, well, okay, well, let's do a crime story. Let's do an epic crime story where this guy
has to deal with the idea that he's a vigilante and then face off against, okay, what's the Joker? Well, the Joker's always been the guy that kind of laughed at him. Well, Batman was so serious, you know? And then, well, okay, well, Batman is trying to bring order to chaos because crime is all about, you know, is disruptive to society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that makes him a fascist in some people's eyes because here is this rich capitalist dude just trying to, like, you know, breaking the legs of a bunch of guys just trying to feed their families, right? But then the Joker just represents burn it all, chaos. And so you can get into these nifty ideas with these characters that have been played out in the comic. Anyway, so that, yeah, the Dark Knight is, I think, represents something of giving you what you wanted, but in a way that was unexpected or elevated the material. Easy enough.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm talking about. I agree with all that. The Dark Knight is a great movie.
Sure.
What I'm talking about is people. So people will even if they're trying to say they liked something, they'll try to excuse it by saying, "Yeah, like it's big, dumb fun."
Yeah,
there's been a lot of people, a lot of the defenders of this Jurassic World movie have been like, "Yeah, it's stupid, but you know they totally just go with that."
Right.
But I think it's when you have to say that about something, you're making up excuses for a problem that doesn't exist. You're trying to excuse a problem that doesn't exist.
You're trying to create this like place.
Did it entertain you? That's it. Just a yes or no. Did it entertain you? And the fact is, the majority of the movies that you've seen, that anyone has seen, has entertained. It has done the job. Even if you are disappointed by it at the end, or even if it didn't do things you wanted it to do, you know, the Star Wars movies are a particular example, the Jurassic Park movies, but I mean, like, it's gotten to the point where it used to just be a critic's thing. You know, audiences paid for things, and it became, you know, Titanic made $1 billion. Avatar made $1 billion.
Right.
You know, Last Jedi made $1 billion. But there's a very outspoken group of people in all those examples that complain about it. And they're not, you know, they might not be a target audience or whatever like that, or in the Star Wars case, they were the target audience. But, you know, was it entertaining should be the only thing. And the answer in all these cases, and for all the people that it's been shown to, has to be yes. Because if it didn't succeed in that way, like, you can say you liked something, or, I mean, here's like the rewatchability thing is a particular thing.
Absolutely.
Right? Rewatchability is probably the biggest indicator. And you can say whatever you want about something. You can talk about how There Will Be Blood is a 5-star movie. And it is.
But I'll watch it once every 5 years.
Right. Well, I'll maybe watch it once more in my life. But it is one of the greatest films I've ever seen.
Sure.
But the rewatchability of something is a more honest response.
That's what to
how something hit you. And the thing about the Jurassic Park movies and about the Star Wars movies and whatever is, the people who complain about it watch them over and over because they're trying to find a reason to put into words why they're angry about it or whatever. I think people are contriving things to be angry about. Because it's like, you know, if people don't want to be involved in politics, for instance.
Right.
You know, which, in a way, everyone should be, because you're talking about, especially in a democracy, something that you are in part of being in charge of is a way of life of everyone. And if you bitch about it, that means you're a part of it. And if you bitch about the movies, then you care.
Right.
Right? It's just insane to me that people could... I don't know if I'm fixated on this Jurassic Park movie, but it
no, it's a good place to be.
That's the thing. I didn't read reviews. I'm gonna stop reading reviews in total. If people didn't like that movie, then what it is, and I guarantee this is the case, is that some uppity piece of shit said they didn't like it, and people they trusted went with that, and then that was all the critics, you know, in a domino effect. They didn't want to seem
stupid compared to their uppity right. buddy. And then the more uppity filmgoers saw the critical whatever. And it's an effect of people not wanting to look stupid by liking something. And that's just...
Well, you get into another problem, too, beyond the stupid thing. Well, what's your buddy Armand White all about, right? He was always the contrarian critic that would argue...
I think he does it on purpose.
Well, maybe he does. Right. Maybe he's trolling people. But that's the other thing people
I've
say.
I've never even read any of
his I never have either. I never have either. And some of them did sound like, really? Okay. Yeah. But...
What was the famous one that he loved?
I honestly don't know.
I don't remember at all.
But you said it entertain whether something is entertaining. I think is very crucial to.
You know what Ryan and I were talking about recently? We mentioned this a few times. The movie Clifford,
yeah,
is great.
I don't like Charles Grodin.
It is so funny.
I'm sure
and
it's
it is,
dumb.
And
yeah.
and it was one of the most widely panned bombs. Like
sure,
I mean, there are bad movies. You know, but calling something a bad movie is like there's ineptitude, mm-hmm. but there's nothing that's really bad. Ineptitude is bad. So whatever you call a bad movie, I mean, there's just different levels of how you were entertained by something, but you're still being entertained by it.
Yeah, right. Which is why the whole problematic side of saying that you like something ironically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you yeah, don't.
You know, if you're you entertained, don't. You're entertained.
Yeah. Right.
But there is this like. Said there is still this inevitable pretense about the idea of like, I would say that I'm entertained. To me, the definition of entertainment for me is, and I put it in my review of Drive, to this day, it's getting more and more rare, even with quote unquote good movies, that I can literally just stop and I just watch the damn movie. Mm. I'm just watching the movie. I'm not like, kind of checking the internet. I'm not like eating. I'm not
you
like
put yourself in that position.
I know, but I think a lot of people do. And you know, if I can just sit down here on the couch and chill out, and I'm just watching the movie, then to me that's entertaining. That means that it pulls me, it grabs me, and it holds me. And I think you can factor it in. I think you're right. Jurassic Park is very entertaining because that's the kind of movie I could see watching on a VHS in like a hotel room, you know, like because before, you know, passing out some night, you know, on some family vacation or you know what I mean? Like it would work to do that. You know, you would be entertained by it. You wouldn't be thinking about other things or worried about other things or necessarily even doing other things. It's hard to describe the value of certain things. Like, you know, is one of your favorite movies a movie that you can put on all the time and then just pass out in the middle of? Like, does that mean it's one of your favorite movies, man? Like, I'm not going to put Heat on while I'm folding laundry or, yeah. like,
just
before
because,
bed
just
every
because
night.
Something is like a level of comfort.
Right. Like,
mean, yeah.
The same thing for, like, some, like, sneakers is totally like that for me. Like, that's entertaining. It's comforting. But, you know, I want to get myself to the point where it's like, I don't want to, like, overdo it and then, like, feel like, that kind of wasn't so great, mm-hmm. you know? It's like listening to a song, right? You love it, you love it. If you listen to it 15 times in a week, you might have finally burned yourself out on it, and then you need to just not listen to it for a while. But, yeah, I honestly don't know where it's coming to. I think that there is a lot of react and react against the react with critical stuff these days. I mean, looking at something like the AV Club and just being like, okay, why are these the favorite things of the year? Right. And then you're just like, oh, okay,
you know
I get
you know
it.
So, because I mean, sometimes they get that stuff right. Like,
oh, I'm not saying they don't get it. I think they get it right every time,
yeah.
but then they also, a lot of other times, there are reasons that seem like they're a little tangential outside of the realm of, is this a good story?
Someone will raise an objection or someone will point out that something, for instance, cost too much to make,
right.
which shouldn't matter.
Yeah.
Waterworld, always
right.
point out that it costs so much to make, and so it was technically a bomb.
Yeah.
But that's a very entertaining...
Sure.
Yes, stupid, but once again, why are we qualifying that?
Mm-hmm.
Action film that... It's. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that movie. It's a. I love it. It's a great, entertaining, funny...
I haven't seen it in a long time. I remember
movie,
not
but
hating
but,
it, but... Yeah,
but it's like... So why were we trying to hold it to a particular standard? Why are we holding Jurassic World 2
right.
to a particular standard that you're sitting down in this monster movie and watching these things unfold and the suspense and the action and the yada yada and that doesn't live up to, well, what did you what was it supposed to live up to?
What do you want?
What kind of, you know, what kind, I, once again, like the logic thing, like, you know, what did you logically want to happen in this movie about
dinosaurs? I can think of two things to talk about relative to that, though. Mm-hmm. One is, I think movies aren't for everybody. Some movies aren't, certain things aren't. And so that's a valid thing. You know, like, I'm really not going to, like, talk to my dad about movies hardly ever, really at all.
Right.
About movies. It's not really, maybe, you know, when they were my age and they went to the theater and saw 2001 and stuff, you know, that's, but, you know, that's just not the realm. It's not the kind of shit he cares about, you know. There's people that have different frames of their view in life, and to them, everything is dumb in a movie because it is dumb. You're right. You and I can look at a dumb movie and we don't bother to qualify it as dumb. Sometimes I still will because I'm, you know, sort of trying to kind of, you know, struggling with that, still feeling like some deserve to be treated better, or, you know, like The Dark Knight is an amazing comic book movie. I don't even call it a comic movie. It's a good crime movie. It's a good, good action adventure movie. And then, you know, something like Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows, like, yeah, it's a dumb, fun Ninja Turtles movie. You know, the turtles are still there doing their thing, but whatever, it's not great. But I had fun with it.
Once again, we're holding this thing about mutant
turtles. Right, exactly. And then, but then at the same time, even people would be like, oh, that's all stupid. Like, what are you doing? But yeah, what did I watched recently, and I felt the same way about the first one. This is the opposite of a, where it's a situation where I feel like a lot of people really liked these movies, and I just couldn't, and there are parts of them I do like, but like the Hellboy movies. I just watched the second one, and I was like, this just feels like an episode of a Hellboy TV show or something.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, these effects aren't great or anything else.
I'm with you on this.
It's just like the Ron Perlman character, I get it, it's cool on some level, but like, I feel like things are thin and missing, and it's...
I agree.
It could be because it's a comic book series, and maybe there's a lot more in that series, and maybe people give it a pass, and maybe people like the creature things that Guillermo del Toro does. But like, I was listening to like another podcast, and it was just like, these guys all loved that movie, and I was like,
the second one in particular,
was so great about it?
I don't know.
Like, I mean, literally, you tell this story, like you do this info dump about these elves, and then cut to, okay, fine, if this is a world where there's an underground of magics and fairies and elves and everything, fine. But then the guy like literally goes to like the old Foot Clan lair from Ninja Turtles, and that's where like the ancient elves have been for the past 3 million years or something. Yeah. And then it's just like, I'm going to do this now, Dad. And it's like, what? Like,
see,
like it just
you're now you're going into the logic of it.
I am right,
and I'm able to not do that. But I also just, I mean, here's the thing though: when it comes down to it, if you put it in a yes or no question,
right.
was it entertaining? Yes,
sure.
But. You're right. There's something missing in those movies. There's something.
That's
missing.
What I mean.
The
yeah.
The first one in particular was pretty dull.
I thought so too. I mean, you have the intro character. They both, I think, felt like the first one felt like the pilot to a TV series, and the last one felt like the season 2 finale or something. You know, like it was a big thing that had built, because like, you didn't have all the actual, like you didn't hint at this character through other episodes. I mean, I literally was sitting there like, writing the episodes that would happen between that in my head as I'm mm-hmm. sitting there. I'm like, oh yeah, they'd do some kind of X-Files-y one where they'd fight a squid monster, but then you'd see this other plot with this guy and he's like doing something, and what's he
you're
setting
right,
up?
Yeah. No, you're
and
right,
instead
yeah.
of he just like literally yeah, walks into a, he wa- I just watched it, he walks into an auction and gets the magic part he's always needed,
yeah.
and then like starts raising hell. Like
that's the thing about a comic book series is it's automatically episodic.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and the movie, you're right, absolutely right.
Or serialized, I mean, it's
sure.
both, yeah.
But I mean, in the case of that, it really is, like, there is some serial stuff, but the Hellboy thing was, and he just ended it, he not necessarily ended it, because there's always stories you can tell, but
right.
he finally, like, ended the end of time thing.
Or
whatever
was
universe.
Going on, yeah.
It's about like it is an X-Files monster of the week type thing in
yeah.
a comic book, which absolutely works there. That's how it worked for that TV show. You know what I mean? So you're right. When you're taking it, you're picking and choosing one or two of those things to be a movie.
Yeah.
It's like why did you choose this medium?
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much what I was feeling. I was like, I think, because I love stuff about like an elite team and like all the but then it just
all
ends
the
up
parts, all the parts are there, it just didn't quite fit together.
Yeah, well, even they fit, they just felt rushed and felt missed. Like I said, things were missing because it wasn't, and that's usually the most disappointing for me, because you know, so that was my that was why that didn't work for me. But I don't know. I mean, to me, entertainment has to do with rewatchability. Probably.
I absolutely agree with that. The rewatchability thing is a big thing. I think people want to... they want to put into words why their own subjective opinion about something is probably objective. And you and I are guilty of this.
Somewhat.
The thing is...
You try to point to objective things to justify your subjective opinion to make it more stable and grounded and justifiable. It's like being an attorney or something. You're saying, well, the fact of the matter is that, you know, in Hellboy 2, the villain character is introduced fairly quickly and engages his storyline without any real sense of, like, a plot or a scheme, and such that you're left wondering, why was this not engaged sooner? Like, what about this moment in the story makes you can have like a fairly like by the numbers argument about a lot of these things.
Yeah, but that's about
sometimes it's story mechanics and sometimes it's structure and things,
logistics and semantics. Like, you know, how on a whole, what was your reaction to it as a whole? You know,
sure.
Like that's what it really comes down to. But. I don't know. I think people want to... if they responded to something in a particular way, and then they want to explain to you why that's the correct response.
Well, they do, yeah, but a lot
but, you
of
know, everyone has their reasons for things, and your whole point about being in a particular mood when you've seen something might have a ton to do with a lot of people's reactions to things. I mean, the thing is, when millions and millions and millions of people have seen something, and the majority of them have a particular reaction, they're probably not wrong. But that does not nullify any individual's opinion about it.
No, it doesn't. But I think the problem is that the thing about millions of people, it's a tough nut to crack, because that's not a qualitative thing. That's a quantitative thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a by the numbers. That's this many people went and paid money to see Transformers to get out of the heat on a hot summer day because they wanted to see giant fighting robots,
right.
Maybe, or just because whatever, it was a 3-hour movie and there were some action sequences, and I don't know. I mean, if you polled every single person, you know, would a lot of them shrug and say, yeah, dumb, whatever? I mean, it's tough to, if you do it by the numbers, which you can do, that is your only real objective standard. That's what the corporations, that's what the money has to do, is will this make money, you know, for whatever reasons. I still think it's naive and almost dumb to sort of think, well, we know what the next trend is, or we know what the next thing is,
yeah.
Or I can chase that, I can figure that out. It's like, you kind of do and you kind of don't. You know that, like, people want certain things, and usually those things are good on some level. It doesn't mean everything around it is good. It might be a lot of good enough. And just hitting it at a point in the culture, at timing. I mean, Titanic was number one for months, but that was the driest spell in movies for a while. It came out in like February or March, and it was just like there wasn't anything really to compete with it. I remember that at the time, being like, "Well, it's number one again." I'm like, "Yeah, well, what else is out?" Really, nothing. It was before all of these mid-level remakes of horror movies and all these other things that tend to generally open or at least bite into a week.
Right.
It was before comic book movies.
It was.
Yeah. And so you can look at that and be like, okay, now Avatar is a little harder to figure out, but that's, I mean, the effects in that and the 3D was also a big deal then.
Right.
So it was really a spectacle thing. I think it was a summer release. It was Christmas, huh? So, I mean, trying to figure out when these big movies that made $1 zillion, what about them did that, is different. And then the politics, not even the politics, but just the marketing of all these things have changed, because I'd love to see a list of, like, the top grossing movies from before, like, even, like, 1985, and get that list cross-referenced with how many of those opened at number one.
and know how many of them might have opened it, two or three, word of mouth.
Right. Back in those days, I mean, staying power had as much to do with box office cumes as anything else.
Right, yeah. Now it's more about, like, if we can just trick enough idiots to go in on that first weekend to see it, then we can recoup enough of our loss. Or we can say it's a hit, and then that'll trick another round of idiots into going in to see it. You know, not to be too harsh on people, but I mean, if that's I'm taking the perspective of, you know, the studio head or whatever. You know, we're just, our product is this thing, and we know people want this kind of thing, and we're going to try to do our best to give them that. But we also maybe want to try to do something new. Or guess what? The money was spent, and we didn't succeed. We tried to build this thing, and it doesn't completely stand up. But let's pretend it does, because in 3 minutes we can make it look like it does. And there you go. So there, you're back to the trailer thing, and then the quantitative qualitative. So the critical thing is maybe a more interesting thing to look at. But I think you're right, that's becoming more problematic, because you might see that all the critics didn't like the new Jurassic movie, but it's making $1 zillion.
Right, but here's the thing, how often is something actually polarizing with critics? It usually isn't.
I think
if it is, it's because there are people who admit they found something entertaining, and other people who can't get past the fact that it wasn't quote-unquote good. That's a particular thing. But otherwise, take most movies... And you're going to see 70% or 80% or 90%. So you're not really getting usually something where you have two smart critics saying opposite things.
Wasn't that what was so great about Siskel and Ebert? Because that would happen sometimes.
Right, it would.
And it was just two guys.
Yes.
And they were both right. I think Ebert was through a Pulitzer at Siskel, but whatever,
laid out their... cases for why it did or did not speak to them,
and they would argue about it with each other, and that was funny.
It was great
at times, but it was engaging. Yeah,
but so I wonder how much of it now is just this.
Do you really think a lot of people are just scared and they want to be part of the in crowd? And they don't. But then there's also the contraries, right?
I don't think. Here's the thing. The vast majority of people loved The Last Jedi.
Okay.
People who didn't are extremely vocal, and an extremely small portion of them. So you only hear about that stuff. If somebody really had a problem with something, they're going to loudly make it known what the problem is and why you should also not like it.
Yeah.
I guarantee you 99% of everyone who is not a critic... sees the Jurassic Park movie is going to love it.
Okay.
And or that did already. Love it.
Well, yeah, it's making a lot of money.
And that's what it comes down to. You know, when they do that thing where they do the exit polling.
Yeah.
And sometimes the numbers between the Rotten Tomatoes score and then the exit poll of what fans thought, sometimes those are vastly different. And what's telling is sometimes the fans come out and don't like something as much as the critics did. Which is always very interesting to me.
I think that would be the most useful thing to study.
Right.
Honestly, because you do want to create something that has mass appeal, and you do want to know, well, what's this thing that the critics all loved that the audience didn't like?
Right.
Because that would be trying to get at... That answers two questions. That answers, what are people really looking for in movies, and then what are critics really gravitating towards in their criticism these days?
I think criticism should be taken as its own form of entertainment, because God help us if you're basing your opinion on what this guy thinks, whether or not you should go spend money on it. I don't think most critics are even trying to do that. They're just trying. I think most critics would tell you the same idea that Ebert had, which is go see movies. Ebert would rarely say don't see this movie.
Right.
He would say if he didn't love it or whatever, but. Or even if he hated it. A lot of times his bad reviews of things were so entertaining that kind of make you want to go watch it, you know?
Sure.
I'll go watch
it. Well, you're back now to that, you know, if it disgusts you...
You're having a reaction.
Right, yeah, with Ebert, he really hated it? Well, that's curious, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it'll be really funny or interesting in a way, or...
Sure, but anyway, I think the media in particular, the media that's reporting on what critics have said about a movie, for instance, which is weird in itself.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, that's all. It's all publicity horseshit.
Right.
Yeah.
But like, they're like, oh man, the critics really don't like this. Why are you telling us that?
Right.
If I didn't go looking for what the critics thought about it, why are you telling me this when I didn't go looking for their opinion? Why are you telling me that their opinion is bad? You know, like that's weird to me. Like,
I think a lot of times they want to play these sides because the entertainment people, you know, the Entertainment Tonights and all of these things, they kind of want to be like, your movie failed critically. Right. But it was a box office success, so, you know, those critics are so snooty and artsy.
Remember Ratatouille, right?
The Pixar movie, yeah.
And that's about making a movie. That's a movie about movie making.
Because it's about making, you know, baking pies.
Right, but I mean, there's a critic in it. And it's about the critic. And the whole thing is about this critic. And at the end, he makes something so simple that the critic remembers what was so great about what he got into in the first place, you know?
I remember that being one of the best examples of visualizing the joy of flavor, which would be, I thought would be such a... They must have really struggled with that. Maybe not. Maybe it came too quickly, but like, okay, we have to convey that this is a food critic, and how do we do taste?
Well, right.
That's not an element that you have access to with cinema. You can't smell anything. Yeah. You can't taste anything. So this guy put something in his mouth, and then visually, what are we going to do? Is he just going to go,
It shows his memory.
Yeah, the memory, and he connects dots to comfort.
It's very
and joy.
Very Proustian.
Sure, but it's also very, you know, it's schmaltzy and whatever, but it works, and it's true. And
yes.
I remember thinking that was a genius thing for
it
them
is. And,
to,
and,
to do.
You know,
to
and, that's, and that's a phenomenal movie, and it's
Brad Bird.
And Bird is great, but it's about, you know, a lot of people try to say that his stuff is about kind of a Randian objectivism, where, like, you know, a lot of people link his stuff to very right wing thoughts because it's about
the individual overcoming
all of his movies are
I haven't seen Incredibles 2
his movies are about this sensational talented individual who should be treated like a god amongst the lowly and plebes. That's what people's argument is. Not that there's an argument.
You've got a whole family and then like other people
treated specially. And Ratatouille's about guy who should be treated specially. And Tomorrowland was all about that.
Yeah, that one was his flop, right?
Everyone's can have a flop, you know?
And Ghost Protocol was about rocking that hoodie. And yeah, I've been rewatching those, so I'm about ready to watch that one.
That was a great thing about the relationship with critics and everything. And at the end, it's like, you know, ironically, after all of it, it still comes down to the critic telling people about it.
Right.
After all that, of course, now this time he's singing a different tune because the thing reminded him of his childhood. So criticism is such a weird thing. And I'm sure both you and I at some point in our lives aspired to be the type of person who could tell others that a movie was or was not good and have people follow your advice, right? Like, I mean, I was a film critic.
Right.
And if there had been an opportunity for me to make a living doing just that, I would have taken it. And now looking back on that, I can understand just what a miserable and awful and empty existence that would be.
Well, I mean, that's
you're holding yourself to this godlike who lives and who dies.
If you take yourself that seriously,
but I think they all do. I think all the critics do.
Some do, and some can kind of just. I mean,
if you care that much, people think about your opinion.
You put it on the internet.
You seek that out as that's different.
Right.
You seek it out as your occupation.
Sure.
That's different than Letterboxd. Letterboxd is giving that power to the masses. I understand.
Sure.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
I don't care to do it, but
or a podcast.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I mean,
I started this podcast because I was listening to other podcasts and I was hearing people either making points about things or having things, and I was like having that like Hellboy 2 moment where I was like,
you want to explain your own.
I want to like get into the discussion. Engage with others about
we have to conversations see right. that the vast majority of film goers don't have about movies. There it usually comes down to, would you like, you like that? Yeah, it was good. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I mean, that's, you know, right? Who's not going to be in a slightly good mood at the end of a movie on a Friday afternoon, you know, or evening with the, you know, with their special lady or whatever, you know, like, especially, hey, did you enjoy it? It's like, yeah, we had a good time. Yeah. We're going to go home and fuck. I'm in a good mood right now.
But that's an honest, immediate reaction.
Sure it is.
And that's what you and I have, you know? And then afterwards, you know, days later, ooh, I have a problem with something that happened in that movie that I didn't think about at the time. But it successfully tricked you into not thinking about it at the time.
At the time, yeah.
You know, a movie isn't, I mean, your reaction to art, you can have multiple reactions. It's different. You're having different reactions to it.
Because you change as a person.
Yeah, and any day, you know, successive days or years later or whatever when you see it. And it's all due to contextual things in your own life.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, a film critic is seeing something once and immediately giving you an opinion about it. And what's, you know, so they'll go back years later and they'll be like, you know, re-review things. Like, then, you know, Rolling Stone does it with albums. Like, they'll have given something or whatever, and then in retrospect, they go back and they give it a 5-star, one of the rarest things they can ever do, and be like, you know what, this turns out this was an all-time classic, whatever. And at the time,
it stood the test of time, yeah.
And
which is kind of cowardly in a way.
Conversely, they'll flip it sometimes.
I think flipping it is maybe more beneficial, especially for music, because people get really hyperbolic about
people
music.
Get very hyperbolic about music in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
It tends to be that the things that are great are misunderstood when they first come out, music-wise.
Sure.
You know, things that are very great artistically, maybe there's something in the sound where you're like, this isn't right, but it picks at you and claws at you, and years later you understand that it's because it's this very complex and deep work of art that's, you know, so great. With movies, that's not, I don't know, music is simple.
Yes, but music criticism, I think, is really complicated.
Music criticism is
because
a lie.
Because a movie, you use your ears and your eyes, and you generally have to stop, drop, and pay attention. With music, 9 times out of 10, people put it on the background while they vacuum or something,
you know,
or they're driving,
the
or they're doing other things.
That always
it's rare that somebody gets their headphones on and sits down and listens
to
the album.
Go
to
a concert.
Yeah.
Go to an orchestral concert.
Yeah.
And you were forced to sit there and
yes.
And deal with music, which is why a lot of people can't do it, because they need to be doing something else.
Right.
And that's how movies, you know, supersede that, is the fact that it's giving you multiple senses and it's forcing your attention.
Yeah.
So it's holding you captive.
Which is...
Music is not holding you captive.
And all the criticism that I've tried to do the entire time I've done this futile podcast, you know, which I think is... Our conversation tonight has been fairly apt to the title, has been to point out those kind of, like, the value of this thing, of this art, of music, or not music necessarily, but of movies and comics and TV and whatever we talked about in all these years is like... Yeah, this was a fun thing to do on a summer afternoon. You know, I read this comic or I watched this movie. You know, I've always put all those contextual things in there because I'm not saying, guess what? I, as a critic, can objectively tell you that this is good all the time in these contexts. And having viewed it once, I'm like, eh, you know.
But I used to think that was the case. I used to think that because I am more intelligent than the average
person,
which, first of all, I'm not, and more intelligent a film goer as the average person, which, by the way, I'm not. I have more understanding of the background and everything that goes into it.
Maybe.
Sure.
Literate is probably the better term than intelligent.
But when it comes down to it, my opinion is it should not be weighted any greater than some retards who goes to see movies. Like, when it, you know, that's the same. They're getting up. They're having an emotional, intellectual response to what they've seen. The art or entertainment.
If they are, I mean, I think that the greatest
if
kind
they
of
are,
tragedy
sure. yeah,
is
some people
it,
aren't.
It, is,
not
it, is it somebody just kind of shrugs and like, "Oh, it was all right." I'm like, "Okay." I mean,
that's an honest reaction.
That is an honest reaction. That's a reaction, but it doesn't really do anything for it. And then you're just like, you know what? That's fine. That's not a movie person. If I'm at a barbecue and I'm asked, you know, "Hey, did you see the Keanu?" "Yeah, it was all okay." And it's like, okay, yeah, I'm not going to talk to you about this then. Well, I'll try to find something else to talk with you about. You want? What do you like to do? You like to
Well, you, I mean, your reaction to any piece of art it's a very complicated thing, and it could change. And I mean, it could be something they just don't care about. But I mean, like you present someone with, you know, to walk them up to that painting right there and have them tell you about it. Here's the thing: when it comes down to it, it doesn't matter. It tells you something about the person, right? So someone's response to a movie that tells you about that person.
We're back to the Klosterman thing that we talked about in one of the first podcasts, which is that, you know, sometimes criticism says more about the critic than it does about the art.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you're right. But I feel like that's all. What it can tell you about someone is maybe it tells you something very simple, which is just that person isn't a movie. I saw one movie last year and it was Transformers, and it's like, because that was the big movie. And
but there are films that speak to people who aren't movie people.
Absolutely.
So why didn't the movie grab someone who's not a movie person when something else did?
Right. You know? So you can delve, I'm talking about the practical side of like a cocktail party conversation with somebody that you just meet. Yeah,
cocktail parties, those things that happen?
Yeah, I guess. And it's like, you know, yeah, you gauge it pretty quick, you know. I mean, you might ask somebody, what's your favorite movie? And then get a sense of why they do or don't like something, and then they can tell you more about them, and you can kind of move on from there. But some people don't give a shit about movies, and that's perfectly fine too. It doesn't mean they don't appreciate art. It doesn't mean, it's just one of many art forms. I mean, there's all kinds of art forms. If I think about like jewelry design or something, sure. Like I don't really. I don't have any
sculpture or whatever. I mean,
metallurgy, all kinds of things.
People are
chemistry, geology.
if you're creating something,
yes,
it's art, kind of. Yeah. You know, like on purpose. It's not like shitting out a kid is art, but I mean, like something you've handcrafted, and and handcrafted can mean any number of things. Like movie making is handcrafting, even if you have no arms,
right?
I don't know. Critics, so I think after all this time, I feel like I've learned this, and maybe just, the new generation of
nouveau critique
of critics are just young, stupid people, but they all think they're smarter than, and I think as they age, you know, Ebert himself said that, you know, as he aged, he became more appreciative of things because he understood how little he knew before. So as you age and you grow in your appreciation and tastes and all this stuff, you can look back and be like, man, I should not have been so hard on something, or I was wrong about it or whatever. But you are never more set in your opinion and never more sure of how right you are as when you're young.
Absolutely.
And as you age, you understand that not only didn't I know shit back then, but I don't know shit now. So, the more you know that you know nothing, the better off you are, et cetera, et cetera. So when people are like so steadfast in their condemnation of a movie, especially one that has done well financially, which is the vote of the masses,
right?
I question them. I question the critic if they hate something that makes $1 billion.
Yeah, and I think that like Ebert is a good example because I think he came up in a window of time.
He was such a populist. He is more appreciable as a critic. You know what was interesting is Pauline Kael was too.
Yeah.
Especially as she aged, because she had very particular, pronounced tastes and was very critical of the wrong thing. But I mean, toward the end there, she was like, she loved some, you know, major trash and garbage, and was like, you know, this was really entertaining. I mean, she never said it like Ebert did. She always had more. She had reasons, and Ebert was just like, "I love this."
Ebert wrote like a column, and she would generally write like essays,
write books,
and stuff.
Yeah.
So which doesn't exist anymore. Now it's blogs. So the marketplace has changed, and Ebert kind of was a part of that change. Not, I don't know that he necessarily contributed to it, but it just was affected by it. Because, like you said, in the beginning, that's what people were looking for. Because film criticism, when it was shot on films, was similar to art criticism, because it was art criticism, which is all about creating a, why should you pay this much money for this? Why should this be valuable? Why should this
that's,
be...
But that, and that's you're a right, review. You're, that's not criticism.
Criticism
is regardless of money. It's regardless of whether or not the consumer should purchase it.
You'd think so, but what it becomes...
I think it's just about... It's just talking about the thing,
right?
About
but
whether or
but
not
then, but then because it. These critics have names that we know... It's because there than put in a lofty place. Like you were saying, you would like a younger version of you would have liked that idea. But then as they age, they begin to realize or begin to get comfortable in a position where it's like, yeah, you know what? Like, I've already made my bones and I can take a deep breath and I can see as the marketplace has changed and blockbusters have become a thing or whatever. Like Ebert, to me, the biggest example I can think of within the context of the Siskel and Ebert show, when I was a little kid, you talk about watching movies a bunch, going to see them a bunch. I think one of the few movies I saw like more than twice at the theater was, I think I almost saw it three times, was the first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie mm-hmm. when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And I was like, I loved it. And I was watching the Siskel and Ebert show, and I mean, you know, whatever. Like, usually it was snooty movies. You know, there'd be two snooty yeah. movies and a popcorn movie, and every now and again they'd give right. the popcorn movie a pass and say, you know, Die Hard is actually a pretty entertaining, yeah. you know. And then they just, like, couldn't stand it. They didn't hate it, but they just were kind of like, this, you know, they missed the mark for it. And then I remember years later when the third one came out, I didn't even see the third one in the theater. I was already done with it, you know, like, whatever. The third one's not good at all. The third one's lame. The first one is good. I've revisited it a few times. It's actually a pretty yeah, good, like, by the way, it works. It is,
yeah.
Effects are good, the action sequences mm-hmm. are good, and the storyline is good, and the characters are good. And then I saw them, and their review for the third one was much more tempered and just kind of like, you know, this isn't for us, but yeah. whatever. So that was like the next
interesting
step.
Interesting that they could have
yeah.
come to that conclusion first of all.
Yeah, you know? Right. Like, yeah, yeah. And then as you got on towards it, you know, Ebert's big thing started being like, what was the intention behind the making of this? Mm-hmm. If the intention was that it's a slasher movie and they made a slasher movie and it like had, you know, blood and guts and whatever, they did a pretty good job of making a slasher movie.
Right.
That's not a failure as a movie.
Right.
And he
would differentiate between his own criticism or review.
Right.
If he gave you a review, he was telling you, like you said, with that, with the intent thing, and did they succeed in doing this thing that they tried to do? That's a review.
Yeah.
I mean, not that that's not an artistic criticism as well, but that has no bearing on a consumer's opinion. That it should not. The critical aspect would be, you delve deep into it and you give an analysis. What does it mean? What does it mean to me?
Yeah.
And, you know, reviewers are trying to do that. And then I think the intelligentsia of filmgoers, the people who hold themselves in even higher esteem than critics in most cases, they're the ones who want their opinions to matter.
And they're the new critics because it's about a blog.
Exactly.
Thing. And it's about opening correct. Things up. And it's about trying to nudge and steer and adjust culture through all of these things.
It's their own way. It's their own artistic... because as Ebert always said, criticism itself is a form of entertainment. Yeah. And I absolutely agree with that. It's their own creative output is to tell people what they think of something and to make that matter, to make people care what you think about something else is like a really twisted art form. I want people to care because that way I say matters.
I matter
right. if they care what I think.
But I think it is, it's completely like all the other ones. It's what stand-up comedy is. You know, I'm going to stand up and tell you my opinions on things and make jokes. You're going to stop. You're all going to shut up and you're going to pay attention to me. Absolutely. And then you're doing the same thing when you decide to make a movie. You're like, I got an idea in my head that I think right. I need to push,
yeah.
and I got, and then, so then I see that somebody creates that idea, and I'm like, you know what? I don't think that idea worked, and I think the idea I have about the idea of that is something I need to share because mm-hmm. I think if people are going to accept that idea out there is the right thing to do. I need to at least say, no, I think it's wrong.
But when it comes down to it, that person, that last person in that sequence that you just did, is just trying to have people pay attention to me. Pay attention to me. That's all it comes down to. Pay attention to me.
Yeah.
And like you said, sure, the filmmaker was saying that first. Pay attention to me. Here's a story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. So Brad Bird's... ideas about critics were interesting because they are very pay attention to me, and they exist to be appreciators of something, and yet they spend so much of their lives shitting on it.
This is a Brad Bird thing?
Oh yeah, that's Ratatouille, you know?
Oh like, right, oh yeah, right.
And it's not, it's, and that's the, and that's also the, you know, it's the antagonist, that's the American government in the Incredibles. They, you know, it's almost like a mean, it's kind of a weird stance to take, but it's almost like, you know, oh, are you jealous of me because I'm so great?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that shouldn't stop me from continuing to be great. You can't stop me from being great just because you're jealous. Like, that's
like, I think it's a lot thinner in Incredibles because I think the government was like paying to move them and they knew who they were.
But the government was very unoppressive.
Yeah, well, yeah, right. That was a public
thing. They outlawed it, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, that was a good one. Here's to 400 more, huh? Mm-hmm.